Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks. Welcome back, Sharkies. Today we have Jessica Pate with us, who is a manta ray expert, and we're so excited to talk with her today about all of her knowledge about manta rays and her really awesome article. But before we get into that, Jessica, thank you so much for being here. Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, no, it's great to be here. My name is Jessica, and I research manta rays in Florida. I'm a scientist with the Marine Megafauna Foundation. And I founded the Florida Manta Project in 2016 to study an unstudied population of manta rays off the coast of Florida.
Awesome. Yeah, we're so excited to talk about your expertise about manta rays. And we have a really cool article that we have that we're going to break down with you that you wrote. Imani, do you want to introduce that article to our Sharkies for us?
Yes, absolutely. So the article that will be the base of our conversation today is titled Urban Manta Rays, Potential Manta Ray Nursery Habitat Along a Highly Developed Florida Coastline. And the summary for this article is the giant oceanic manta ray, Mobula birostris, was listed on the U.S. Endangered Species Act in 2018. Part of listing a species on the ESA leads to an increased need and priority to identify critical habitat. Yet nursery habitat where juveniles reside has yet to be documented for this species. In this study, Jessica Pate and colleagues did boat-based surveys with the assistance of drones and airplanes to locate manta rays and used snorkelers to capture photo identification of individuals and evaluate sexual maturity. In this study, they observed 42% of individuals more than once and saw 8 individuals over multiple years, suggesting that the area they surveyed is likely nursery habitat for the species. They also documented wound healing of individuals they saw repeatedly, allowing for insight in how frequent manta rays may experience injury and recover.
I'm so excited about this article. I have so many questions already. And actually, I am like a pretty temperate researcher. I'm not often in Florida waters or tropical waters at all. And so I actually learned from your paper that there's 3 species of manta ray. I didn't know that until that paper. Is that correct? Or you look like you're going to correct me. Tell me
technically,
more.
Technically, at the moment, there are 2. And actually, manta birostris actually will go up into temperate waters. They're seen like off the coast of like New Jersey and New York. But yeah, so there are currently 2 recognized species, Mobula birostris, which is the giant manta. As its name suggests, this is the larger of the 2 species and is considered to be like a more oceanic wanderer. It's very global in distribution and is a more like open ocean pelagic ray. The reef manta, Mobula alfredi, is smaller, but it's still really big. You can get up to 4 or 5 meters across. And they're found more in the Indian and Pacific Oceans, a lot around the east coast of Africa and in Asia. And they're, as their name suggests, more associated with coastal reef habitats. And
got it.
The 3rd species of manta ray has not been formally described yet. It's something my colleague Andrea Marshall has been working on for about a decade now after she described the other 2 species. So this species would be endemic to the Western Atlantic and Caribbean. So that would include our Florida mantas. And so they would be very endemic to a smaller area than the other manta species. And they would have split off from Mobula birostris at some point. So we think that, and this is like very recent in evolution, like we're talking tens of thousands of years.
I love that that's recent.
It it's crazy recent in terms of evolution.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
But there's been quite a few, like three or four genetic studies that back up them being a genetically distinct group. There's some taxonomic evidence. So we think that maybe they've become more kind of like a reef manta, like they're kind of got that the same ecology where they're more like coastally associated. But there are some Barosteris that I personally never see in Florida, but other people will see kind of further offshore that kind of pop up every now and then.
Oh, that's so cool. So they do have some overlap then, those two species.
Yeah, there's overlap. There's probably some hybridization as well.
So side question, how do you like formally define a new species? What does it take to be able to say this, there is a third species of manta ray?
Well, this might cut into like my field story. but or one of them. Basically, if you, there's a great paper by my colleague Andrea Marshall where before she started studying manta rays, there was only one species of manta ray throughout the ocean. In 2009, she split the genus Manta, which actually the genus Manta no longer exists. The taxonomy of mantas and mobulas has been undergoing lots of changes in the last decade. So basically, having taxonomic evidence, so laying very clearly out how you identify this species from this species. And with these mantas, there's a lot of individual variation and it can be very difficult. I mean, we're looking at stuff like the shape of the denticles and how many teeth they have. I actually got to use scanning electron microscope to examine the denticles and teeth, which I was terrified of, but it was really cool.
I love denticles.
This is Amani's love language.
I don't like trying to pick individual ones out of skin. That was very difficult. So many. But we actually collected a type specimen. So a type specimen is a specimen that's stored, that's used to describe a species. So we actually had a dead manta come ashore in Florida 4 years ago now, which is super, super rare. And we managed to collect it, and now it's being stored at the Smithsonian for type material for the new species of manta ray.
Oh, very cool. So we got our mantas figured out, and you're studying the one off the coast of Florida. So before we get too far into your paper, let's talk about some of the current threats for manta rays. We talk about this with sharks a lot, and today we're talking about an awesome relative, but they experience a lot of the same threats as sharks do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's kind of the classic threats that are affecting everything in the ocean, like climate change, habitat destruction. But really specific to mantas, and their main threat while their populations are declining is related to fisheries. They're both targeted and caught as bycatch. Manta rays have these cephalic fins that come off their face, and these things are just perfect for getting tangled into gill nets. Manta rays are obligate ram ventilators. So if they can't swim, they can't breathe, and they'll drown in these nets, which can be a big problem in some places. But they're also targeted. Their gill plates are sold in traditional Asian medicines as like a cure-all health tonic, basically. And they can be sold for a lot of money. So fishermen, some anglers, places do target them for their gill plates, and that has driven up the demand for mantas around the world, unfortunately.
Interesting. But they're not targeted in the U.S., right? Because they're on the endangered species list?
Yeah. So I've learned a lot about policy and government stuff. So they're listed as threatened under the endangered species list, which doesn't provide a whole lot of actual protections.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So what I've learned, if you're listed as endangered, it's different. But if you're listed as threatened, in order for there to be like a no take provision, they have to submit, an exception to the rule, which actually has not been submitted for the manta ray for lots of red tape reasons. But so I found that fascinating. Luckily, mantas in Florida, there's lots of state protections. They're illegal to catch in Florida. And really, traditionally, there is no fishery in the United States for mantas. They're caught as bycatch minimally in some fisheries. And back at the turn of the 20th century, there was some like harpoon fisheries. Like there's photos of Teddy Roosevelt with manta rays on the beach in Florida that he harpooned.
No way.
Freaking Sylvia
what?
Earle.
I need to find this photo.
Oh, I have it in my presentation. Sylvia Earle also harpooned a manta ray for research. It's in her book. They dissected it on the Sarasota fishing pier, and while they were dissecting it, people cooked it and ate it.
Oh my gosh. Hey Sharkies, a quick correction here. It was actually Eugenie Clark that hunted that manta ray and fed it out, not Sylvia Earle. So we just want to make sure that credit is where credit is due.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. Learn something new every day. This conversation about entanglement is bringing me back to our episode with Christian Parton, where we talked about having morphology that kind of predisposes you for being entangled. And I think it's really interesting that you mentioned that in your study, since they have these, what are they called?
Cephalic fins.
Okay. I always want to say cephalofoil. Since they
That's
have
the
those
hammerhead.
Cephalic fins. Yeah. Since they have those cephalic fins at the front, that would make them definitely like predisposed to being entangled by things just flying around, because it's basically just hooks on their face.
Yeah. They get entangled really easily. And part of the reason mantas can't undertake any of this fishing pressure is because they have very conservative life history strategies. And, you know, elasmobranchs in general, as I know you guys know, have conservative life history strategies, but mantas are even conservative for an elasmobranch. They're pregnant for an entire year. They have one single pup that's born at like 1.5 to 1.8 meters across. So they have one very large pup, and then they can take 2 to 5 years off between pregnancies. So
wow,
they can't really withstand any kind of fishing pressures to their
right.
populations. They cannot recover very quickly.
Wow. Yeah, that is a slow replacement rate there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man. So one of the things I wanted to touch on also, and I mean, kind of going back to the policy part, was that part of the Endangered Species Act wants to identify critical habitat, right? Once an animal is listed within the Endangered Species Act. So that was one of the goals of your paper, was to identify if this location that you were surveying was a nursery ground for manta rays. And what are those three criteria that you have to start to evaluate to know whether or not a habitat is a nursery ground for a species?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And the three criteria for an elasmobranch nursery habitat is that the habitat is repeatedly used across years, that individuals have a tendency to remain over time, and that more juveniles are found in the nursery area than other areas. And two of these criteria were pretty easy for us to provide evidence for. And the last one was a little more difficult. And I also just want to say that just because I can prove that these three criteria for a nursery ground are met does not mean that it'll be defined as critical habitat.
Oh, interesting. Why?
Yeah,
that?
So for NOAA to classify something as critical habitat, you have to say what the physical and biological parameters of that nursery habitat or that critical habitat are. So why are they here and not somewhere else? So it's a pretty steep definition, and you know, they're supposed to define critical habitat within a year of listing, and they basically said that they couldn't. So we're working with NOAA currently on satellite tagging studies to help get a better idea of the parameters of what the critical habitat is.
Those are some pretty strict guidelines. That seems like a very hard task to prove those points in order to get critical habitat.
That's why you have to have very long-term data sets. And we just started a feeding ecology study to hopefully kind of define what the environmental factors influence the food resources. So maybe we can model, you know, what they eat and what conditions provide for that food.
Right. Yeah, this is making me think, like, at the rate that we're kind of changing ocean climate, if you have to have really long studies to determine critical habitat, would species be around long enough for you to be able to define that habitat, given how quickly they may be dying off? That's the question that just popped into my head, is like, at what point do you change the rules because of how fast we as people are changing the planet?
I mean, that's a depressing thought. Yeah, also, the critical habitat could be changing as the water warms.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we'll figure it out before then.
Yeah, that was mostly just like a rhetorical question. I was not expecting you to have an answer to that. It was kind of just like where my brain kind of wandered when we were talking about like having to have long studies, and also the fact that things are constantly changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So can you explain to our listeners exactly where you were studying these mantas off the coast of Florida?
Yes. Yeah, so I am on the southeast coast of Florida, in Palm Beach and Martin County. So we're on the Atlantic side, and our typical survey area for our boat-based surveys is between Boynton Beach and Stuart, Florida.
So how did you choose those survey locations?
Yes. So basically how I got interested in studying manta rays is I started out my career studying sea turtles, and that's actually what I studied for my master's thesis. And when you're studying sea turtles here in Florida, you get up at the crack of dawn and you ride an ATV up and down the beach all day and count sea turtle tracks. I've counted thousands upon thousands of sea turtle tracks. But while I was out on the beach and I was working here in Palm Beach County, I would sometimes see mantas swimming by the beach, literally in like 3 feet of water. And, you know, I was a scuba diver and I knew scientists, and no one seemed to know anything about the manta rays here. Now, the paper I published was really the first study of manta rays in Florida. So there's only one other paper from 1998 that says there were three mantas in the Indian River Lagoon in the 90s. And that's it.
Oh my gosh.
So
is it pretty rare to see them off the coast of Florida?
So the thing is, it's rare for divers to see them. They're not found on the reefs. So where we're seeing them is really close to shore, usually in like less than 20 feet of water. I mean, literally sometimes I've been standing while they swim by.
That's so amazing.
It just isn't where people were looking. And some people knew they were there, like some anglers and other people, but no one seemed to know. Like, I hear anglers be like, oh, I always see this one manta ray, the same one's been coming around. Probably a different one that you've been seeing. But yeah, so there just wasn't really anything known about them. And yeah, I wanted to learn about them. And so that's why I chose this area. It's just because that's where I happened to work and happened to see them.
Right.
Yeah.
So, right.
It was kind of fortuitous, because I actually think it is a pretty good area to look after doing some searching around.
I mean, I think that happens with scientists a lot. You kind of look sometimes in your own backyard and you're like, why is nobody else looking at this? That's what happened with me in Seven Gills. I was like, there's Seven Gill pups in San Francisco Bay. Why is no one looking at this? This is so cool.
I really need to see a Seven Gill pup.
Right?
Come to San Francisco.
Don't we all?
I will come.
So one of your primary methods for this was using drones and planes to kind of spot and find these mantas. Can you just explain what that looks like for our Sharkies that are listening?
Yeah, so actually I saw that question that you sent. And we actually didn't use drones and planes that much for the results that are published in this paper. When we started out, I would literally go out on 20-foot outboard boat and stand on the bow so I could get as high as possible and basically just look for black shapes in the water. So for the first, yeah, I still can't believe
talk about being an eagle eye.
Oh, I mean, we stared at a lot of rocks in the beginning.
Oh my gosh. I see a rock.
That way. Is it moving? No,
it's
moving.
It's a manta rock.
Oh, I mean, that's a legitimate thing. I can tell you where certain manta rocks are because we see them all the time.
That's amazing.
So that's how we started out doing everything. And that's how we did it till the end of the summer of 2019, maybe. Every now and then I would have someone out on the boat who had a drone. And I actually had a friend who was a pilot for his job who flew kind of up and down the shore, and he would tell me when he saw manta rays. So that was helpful. Now we almost exclusively use drones. I use them all the time. My boyfriend says I'm absolutely obsessed. Because I keep buying drone batteries. But yeah, they're amazing technology. I mean, we basically fly it from the boat and just drive the boat along the coastline, fly the drone kind of with the boat. The drone flies 30 miles per hour. So everything is so much faster than it used to be.
Right?
So
yeah,
slow.
Wow.
But yeah, basically we look until we see the black diamond shapes. We were doing it today and found four.
Oh, that's amazing.
You saw four manta rays today?
Today.
Okay, so we're taking a trip to San Francisco and then we're taking a trip to Florida to see manta rays is what I'm getting from this conversation.
That's what I just heard.
I will trade mantas for Seven Gills.
You've got yourself a deal.
I will offer moral support and sarcasm to this deal.
Those are welcome.
Definitely welcome. I mean, that's amazing. I have never used a drone, but I just think that the availability of technology to be able to use for scientific research to me is just so cool. And then the other thing that you did was had a snorkeler in the water to survey the mantas under the water. So how did you take those photographs of the manta rays in water? I imagine that is much more complicated than it sounds just from reading the paper.
Yes, it absolutely is. Yeah, in a lot of places where they do a photo ID of manta rays, it's either at like a feeding aggregation or a cleaning station. So you kind of scuba dive down and wait for the manta rays to come, and you can kind of swim under them and take photos. Ours, we're seeing mantas in really shallow water. Sometimes they're just like swimming directly above the sand in like 4 feet of water. So we utilize GoPros on like 3 foot long poles. So usually the mantas are traveling in one direction and they really want to go in that direction. So if we kind of get the boat ahead of them, we just try to turn the boat completely off and kind of get in and then wait for them to swim past.
And then you just like swim alongside them as quick as you can.
Yeah. I mean, you need free diving fins. I have purchases through the project.
I mean, how hard is it to keep up with them too?
I mean, it's impossible if they don't want you to.
Yeah.
It's just not a thing. So we give them each a behavioral category. Like one is avoidant, meaning they want nothing to do with us. We can't get close to them. I mean, those mantas are extremely difficult. And some want to interact with you. They'll actually flip upside down and swim underneath you upside down. And I've had them do that.
Oh my gosh.
Up to almost 10 minutes.
That is amazing.
I need to go swimming with manta rays just to see one.
You see, this is what happened to me the very first time I swam with a manta ray. And it's why I became a little obsessed, because I was like, I didn't know this was a thing that animals did. And they're really just looking at you and checking you out because they can see better looking ventrally than they can dorsally.
The sharks have a challenger and it's the manta rays.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I just like love that context, honestly, about manta rays and just sharks and their relatives in general, because I think people often think they're just fish and they don't have personalities and they're not maybe as curious as mammals are, but they are. And it's just amazing to see them interact with someone like that or hear about it. Oh, that's so cool.
They definitely have personalities, and like all four of the manta rays we saw today, we knew. And they do. I mean, sometimes they change how they act towards you depending on what they're doing. But yeah, they definitely, some don't care about us and some don't like us and some seem to want to hang out with us. But another cool fact about manta rays is that they have the largest brain of any fish. So we think they're really smart.
Smarticle particles.
Oh my gosh.
I had to say it. I had to. There was no way that wasn't going to come out of my mouth.
That's amazing. Okay, so you have your camera. You try to swim as fast as you can next to them. And then you're gathering a lot of information about those mantas, including their size, if they're sexually mature, what behavior they're displaying at that moment, like you said, feeding or potentially breeding behavior, and a directional heading. Was it possible to get all of that information on each animal that you saw?
No. for today, for example, we had a group of three feeding manta rays, and typically where they're feeding, the vis isn't the best, and we had a lightning storm right next to us. So I put my research assistant in, we got the ID shots and a zooplankton sample, and we got out of there.
Yeah.
So we do the best we can because we're also collecting like genetic samples, putting satellite and acoustic tags on.
Oh my gosh.
Using laser photogrammetry to measure them, and now taking zooplankton samples, which is just time consuming.
Wow. So that is a lot of information all at once.
And you're trying to swim past with them at the same time.
Yeah.
And they don't want to always be near you.
I mean, you pick and choose which ones, like the ones who don't want to be around us. Like, I don't want to harass the manta rays.
Right.
So those aren't going to be a good candidate for satellite tagging. Those we collect the basic minimum information and leave them alone.
Yeah, that makes sense. So in the study that we're reviewing today, you had 150 manta ray encounters that you analyzed for this paper, and 59 of them were unique, which means that a lot of them you actually saw twice, which was, again, one of those things that you're looking for to define a nursery, is if they would continuously show up. And so that was a large percentage that you actually were continuing to see over and over again. Can you describe some of the things that you were able to record because of those encounters? Like, one of the things you mentioned was wound healing.
Yeah, the wound healing is super cool. I was going to give you guys updated numbers.
Ooh.
These don't include today.
Oh my God. I love it.
We have 302 encounters with 116 individuals. Actually, 117 with the one we saw yesterday. I haven't entered that yet.
Oh my gosh.
And we've recited 55 of those. So we're at 47% reciting.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
This is unpublished data.
We've gotten
so cool.
Way better at finding mantas with the drone. And I also found an area that they were kind of hiding out in that I wasn't looking originally. So yeah, seeing them over and over again allows us to document lots of things. And like one thing you said is wound healing. Unfortunately, a lot of the mantas we see in Florida are, we just removed fishing line off of one yesterday and it had like its mouth was all rubbed up from where the fishing line was wrapped around its mouth.
How do you remove that? Because I imagine they're trying to swim away from you, right? How do you get close enough to them to be able to remove the fishing gear?
I should send you a video. Yes. Sometimes they we have a lot of it's on my Instagram. But sometimes they literally, like, I have them like swim below me in circles and let me cut off all the fishing line.
No way.
Yeah, it's totally happened. It's like almost hard to explain other than like they kind of know what you're doing because I cut it all off and then they swam away.
Oh, they're so smart.
That does not always happen.
This is amazing.
Sometimes they don't want you near them. And the minute you pull on the line to cut it, it hurts them and they freak out and they swim away. So it can go both ways, but we've gotten better at it. Basically, you just swim down with shears and do your best, but it's, yeah. Everything's done free diving. So it can be difficult.
It's a battle with needing air to survive.
Yeah. Gills would make everything much easier. But
I can't wait until someone comes up with human version of gills for all of us.
Yeah. We need we need the gillyweed from Harry Potter that gave him gills in the fourth one. I don't know if either of you are Harry Potter people, but that was a thing. And I'm sure some listener knows what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and I was so jealous, and I was like, man, I did not want to be a witch until I read that, and now I really need to be one. That's amazing. Okay, so the other really cool thing that you found with all of these photographs and encounters that you had was that all of the males that you encountered were immature, and 96% of the females were immature, and some of those, the other 4%, were just undetermined if they were sexually mature or not, right? So basically, most of them that you saw were sexually immature.
Yeah, I would feel pretty comfortable saying all, but with males, you can tell by the size of their claspers. And all the males we see have very teeny, teeny, tiny claspers. With the females, they don't have any external way to tell sexual maturity. So we're going by disc width. So at that point, we were only estimating disc width with our eyes, really. And, you know, that is not a very accurate way to do anything. So we had one female who we estimated to be a little larger. So she was kind of in that gray area. But, you know, females are larger than the males. So still to this day, it's all only juvenile males. I've gotten now, we get a lot of citizen science reports. And one of the Barostrace mantas was an adult male this year. That was way offshore. And someone sent me a manta from like 2013 down in the Keys that was an adult male, like super random.
Oh, that's so interesting.
As far as South Florida goes, we've started a new project in Central Florida. That's kind of a whole new thing with that's a seasonal aggregation of adult mantas.
Oh, interesting. But
down here in our South Florida area, we really only see the juveniles.
Oh, that's so cool.
But the juveniles are still really big. You know, they're right. They're 2 to 3 meters across.
I think that what we really need is a manta ray drive through, similar to like a truck weighing station on the highway where they just roll up and you have like a built nice measuring tape to see how long they are, and they just sit and you remove gear from them, like getting their hair done, and then they get to go off and be happy. And I think that we need to talk to the mantas and tell them we need this.
good luck with that.
We just need to learn like manta ray sign language, right? Easy enough.
definitely easy enough.
We do laser photogrammetry, which is basically having a GoPro in the middle of two lasers that are a set distance apart. It does not make you swimming with it. It's not hydrodynamic.
I bet not.
So, but we do have that to get more accurate disc widths. And I've also found it helpful to just snap a picture of them with the drone from the boat, and then you can kind of measure the boat on the computer and measure the manta rays to get some slightly more accurate information. So we're getting more accurate disc widths now, but it's still
all immature. Yeah,
a work in progress.
That's super cool. And I remember reading that one particular immature male you saw 23 times.
Yeah, what was up with that guy?
So it's funny. Gilly is our manta. I haven't seen him. We haven't seen him since 2020. So maybe he's grown up. But it's funny. My friend, who I still collaborate with, she named him after her boyfriend at the time, who she then broke up with. And then he became our most sighted manta. So be careful who you name your mantas after.
Oh my gosh. That's otherwise so funny. You just have like a constant reminder of your ex-boyfriend hanging around.
Yeah, I'm like, Gilly got hit by a boat today. Gilly got entangled in fishing line.
Oh my gosh.
I swear in 2019, I felt like I studied Gilly the manta ray because he was like the only manta I could find. And so like just pop in the water and I'm like, it's Gilly again. Okay.
Oh my goodness. I mean, what do you think his deal was? It was just like a really good habitat and he just wanted to stick around that one place.
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of individual variation probably in how much they move and where they're showing site fidelity.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough. So in this study, you found all of the individuals of the, 150 manta ray encounters, 59 of them were unique and they were all immature. You saw them over multiple years and they were within a pretty close range, right? So when you re-encountered them, they were 15.2 kilometers away from the original sighting, which for those in the US, that's 9.32 miles. Here for you. And so that was actually, is that pretty close for manta ray? Like roughly 9 mile average is pretty close site fidelity for a manta ray?
Yeah. So to be fair, like that's the area where we're looking. So we're going to expect to see them close to where we've seen them before. I just sent you guys, I don't know if you guys can put this like on your podcast notes in the chat, a satellite track of one of our mantas. This is a spot tag from 2019.
Oh my gosh.
And so what you see here is we tagged the manta in like the Jupiter area. And then the manta basically took off up to Daytona Beach, circled back around all the way down to Miami, and then went back and hung out in that area where it was tagged for a couple weeks before the tag came off. So probably what's happening is they're making these like longer distant movements, but showing site fidelity to these certain areas that they like.
This tracking map is so cool. We will absolutely put this in our show notes and we'll put it like out on our posts when we advertise for the episode as well. This is so cool.
Can you see more of these somewhere, or is it just this one that you are tracking right now?
This is the only one we've put a spot tag on and put on the internet. The rest we've put mini pats on, and it's a collaboration with NOAA. So I don't really think I can share data without their permission.
Yes,
that's fair enough.
We won't ask you to do illegal things.
Well, hopefully some of that, our COVID got in the way of a lot of our satellite tagging work with them.
Right.
So we're picking that back up again this year. It's really interesting. So they're capable, mantas are capable of very long distance movements. And these are young mantas. This was a juvenile male, and this track happened over, I want to say like 70 days. So like, you know, it's like a 2-month period and they made these really large movements.
Oh, that's so cool. So you found basically the three parameters that define a nursery habitat, but in your study, you kind of say it's not like positive that this is a nursery habitat. And you mentioned earlier when we were talking that it's probably because part of it might be because you can't define exactly the like the perimeter of it. Is that right? Is that really like the only thing holding you back from saying like this is a nursery habitat for the manta ray?
Yeah, well, actually, when I submitted that paper the first time, I did not have potential in the title. Reviewers made an argument, and I agree with them. Like, I think it's better to, you know, be on the safe side instead of stating too far. And it's that statement that, you know, more juveniles are found here than in other areas. You know, what constitutes these other areas when mantas are capable of, you know, they're capable of really deep dives. They could be out in the open ocean, like in 300 meters deep. You know, they could be all along the coast. And it's just a logistically a difficult thing to quantify. So we're doing aerial surveys that we started in 2019. Where we're flying in a plane from Fort Lauderdale up to Stewart so we can cover more area and get a better idea of the spatial distribution and hopefully model that with the conditions. And then combine that with satellite tagging data and acoustic data and put it all together to kind of figure out, you know, where the actual nursery habitat might be. But this is, it's really rare to see only juveniles. Like, yeah, a lot of the other populations for nursery habitats, you know, they're still seeing like adults mixed in. They're just seeing a lot of juveniles. So it is very unique.
Yeah, that is unique. Or even just like seasonally, the sexually mature adults might come in. Like, do the manta rays give live birth?
Mm-hmm. No one's ever seen it in the wild.
They must be nearby at some point.
That would be my ultimate dream, would be to figure out how all of this works and where they give birth. Although part of me kind of wants it to remain a mystery, maybe for only me to know.
Insider secrets.
I'm here for the manta secrets for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, so the seasonal population, we just started that project last year, but we did witness courtship behavior. So, but you know, then they're pregnant for an entire year. I mean, they could have these babies freaking anywhere.
Yeah. And who knows how far the babies travel to. There was someone, I think it was sand tiger pups when they're born, travel like a really far distance from where they pup. And it's like, you never know where they're actually born.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even have great guesses, but yeah, but some of the ones we see look very like, we can still see like little like umbilical scars sometimes. So I think we're seeing some pretty, pretty young ones.
Oh, I'm just enjoying this so much.
Me too.
This whole episode, I am just like beaming in my room right now.
I know. Young little juvenile manta rays. It's so awesome.
Yeah.
Florida just has so much incredible biodiversity, especially with like elasmobranch diversity. It's so cool.
And we see so much of it on our surveys. We see great hammerheads, sawfish. We saw our first tiger shark last month. I filmed eagle rays mating with the drone.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I just love being out there. We see so much cool
That's
stuff.
Do you need survey assistance? Do you need an extra pair of hands?
if people who can drive boats and fly drones are the most welcome.
I'm working on my captain's license, so I'll call you in a couple years.
same. I'm also working on that. Drones, not so much, but yeah, we got that. We got it figured out, right, Imani?
Yeah, do that. Adding it to my list of things that I need to learn.
We can definitely do that. Okay, well, one of the last things I kind of want to touch on about your paper that you mentioned is that the population in South Florida is increasing, and a lot of the mantas that you experienced had injuries on them. I'm looking up for what the actual percent was.
I can give you the new percent.
Oh, please do.
I think it was, yeah. It was 42 in the paper.
Yeah, it's a little bit less now, I think, because we've been going to this area where there's less people, so we've been seeing less entangled. I really want to look at the spatial aspect of the injuries and the fishing line entanglement, because I really think there's something there, because this area where we were seeing mantas all the time, they're like not there anymore.
Oh,
so I don't know if it's a seasonal thing. Like the area where I would like tell you to go before is like not the hip area. I have no idea why.
Interesting.
Oh, so but interesting.
Right now, the numbers with some kind of injuries is 35%.
Yeah, that's still, I mean, that's still really high to see like fishing line or some sort of injury.
Yeah, fishing line is at 21%.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot. So a large number of them are experiencing what we call anthropogenic impacts, which is human influenced impacts. So obviously a boat strike or fishing line, clearly where a human had caused this injury one way or another. And you mentioned that because the population of humans is increasing in South Florida, this is something we really need to consider with this potential nursery habitat, or basically this nursery habitat of manta rays, and how humans might be impacting a pretty critical part of this species' life history. And I wondered if you wanted to take a moment to just kind of expand on that and the importance of being proactive about understanding how humans are impacting this population.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really big part of what we're working on. So we did another study where we went out and interviewed anglers on their knowledge of and interactions with manta rays. And what we found is that most of the anglers in South Florida are accidentally hooking manta rays. They have their lines out and the manta rays kind of like swim into them is what happens most of the time. And they're not fishing with tackle strong enough to land anything or remove a hook. So usually the line breaks. So, I mean, the severity of what can happen to the manta is highly variable. They do this like barrel roll feeding where they do flips. So if they have a long piece of trailing line, it can get wrapped around their body. And it can really cut into them. There's some really gnarly injuries we've seen. But you know, manta rays are pretty easy to see. You know, they're bigger than 6 feet and dark black. So we're trying to work with anglers to be like, if you see one, just reel in your line until it swims past, like, cause you're going to lose your tackle if you hook this thing.
Yeah.
And they don't want to, they don't have any interest in harming these animals. So we're really working on raising awareness right now. So we have signs at all the fishing piers and inlet jetties, and we're working on a study right now to see if those signs are effective, because we asked people to report manta rays, and about half the reports I get from those signs are not manta rays, which is very interesting to me. People just clump rays as one thing, even though there's a picture of a manta. That was one of the big things we talked to anglers about a lot. They're just like, they know what a manta is. Like, they'll point it out in our little, like, we have a question like, can you identify a manta ray? And they'll point out like, that's a manta. But then when they talk later, they're talking about it as if it's all the same thing as like, cow nose rays or eagle rays.
I mean, I definitely think that's a misconception that people have. Like, manta ray is just like this all encompassing thing, because I'm on the West Coast and people do the same thing. They see a bat ray and they're like, it's a manta ray. And definitely not.
It's not. Definitely not.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's like the biggest thing is to raise awareness that, you know, first of all, they don't believe me that they're babies. They're like, it was huge. And I'm like, they're born at 6 feet across. And they're like, no.
Born at 6 feet across? Like,
that's a baby?
That's a baby manta.
I did not know that. That is really big.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Amani is now stretching her arms wide for reference.
I'm 5'4", so I have to raise my arms to be a baby manta. And I'm just taking in how long that is.
I'm glad I don't have to give birth to that.
I mean, that's why they do it so infrequently.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Before we kind of wrap up this episode, this is our favorite question to ask everybody. What is your favorite field story? And it doesn't have to be from collecting data for this paper. It can just be any field story that is your favorite.
Yeah, so I have a lot of field stories because I've been doing field work for like 15 years. And I was talking to my boyfriend the other night about which one I should share with you guys. I was like, I have one about crashing a sailboat on the beach, or about the dead manta ray, or about some African voodoo stuff. But I told that one on a different podcast.
I mean, all of these sound really great. We'll have to have you come back on to tell us another story.
I mean, yeah, I also flipped my dad off an ATV one time.
Oh my gosh.
So I made the dead manta ray story because it was a crazy day for me. We had been out on the water all day looking for mantas and had not found one. And I got a call from Steve Kajura, who's a shark researcher down here, calling me. This is back in 2017. So my project was brand new, but he was one of my advisors in grad school. So he called me to see if I wanted to come or if I wanted any samples. And I was like, before you cut into that manta ray, can you wait one second? Because I think we might not want to do that. So I call Andrea in Africa. She's like, please, please don't let them cut into it. Please, we're going to figure something out. So I go down there. I had to drive like an hour, convince them not to cut into the manta ray because other scientists wanted like liver and tissue samples for all their different projects. And I was like, please, don't take anything other than measurements. So we were out there for hours while Andrea was on the phone with people trying to figure out a place where we could just put this thing. My boyfriend was out of town, so I stole his truck and we put this manta ray, it was 8 feet
across. Oh my gosh.
We put it in the back of his truck and me and my intern, Trixie, drove 2 hours down I-95 with this dead manta ray in the back. Like the wingtips stuck out the sides. We had to stop and get gas at one point. We left like a huge puddle of like blood by the gas station from where it was leaking out. And we didn't technically have a permit to do this because I didn't know I needed to ask about dead manta permits. And we took it up to Harbor Branch where they have a freezer where they can keep whale carcasses. And I was like, can we keep it here for just a couple weeks? And we kept it there for like 6 months until they were like, you gotta get rid of this thing.
Come get your giant manta ray, please.
It was, when we came to get it, it had actually frozen to the table. And we had to like kind of like wedge it off with like a giant ice picky type thing. That was one of the longest field days of my life. We almost hit a wild boar coming home. I was so stressed out about getting these samples that were going to be used for type material and not messing them up, like trying to remove the tooth band of the manta ray. They have like these little teeny tiny teeth, but they're all kind of together on this one piece of tissue.
Oh, cool.
I have never been more stressed out in my entire life. And we were just, me and my research assistant were like covered. We had like blood matted in our hair. We're still like in our wet bikinis all day long. So it's good that manta ray now lives at the Smithsonian, where she'll remain in perpetuity. So it was all.
They were like fixed it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. In like a big tank.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
Wait, so cool. At the one at the Smithsonian in DC?
Yeah, they have like an annex building for their like larger stuff. So it's at that annex building. I haven't visited it yet. I really want to.
Is this a public thing that like anyone can go see it, or do I have to become friends with someone to go see it?
It's been a really long time since I talked to anyone there, but I'm sure you can ask.
I'm gonna tweet at the Smithsonian and be like, how do I view your large carcasses?
Casual questions we ask on Twitter. Oh my gosh. Oh, that's amazing. I mean, that sounds extremely stressful, but also like it paid off. So all worth
it. Yeah, it did.
All worth it. And you made it. That's amazing.
We made it. My boyfriend's truck has a scratch in it from that day that he never lets me live down. But
it was for the mantas.
Amazing. I would like to say thank you publicly to your boyfriend for allowing the story to be a thing and live on in his truck.
Right? That story did not. Oh, that was like everything I needed. Thank you so much.
I can send you guys photos of the manta in the back of the truck.
Absolutely.
Yes. Please do. I must see this. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for being here today. We learned so much about manta rays, and that story was like definitely didn't disappoint. Where should our listeners follow you? Where can they follow your work and your research? Are you on Twitter? Where should they find you?
I have a Twitter account, but I have yet to tweet. I'm on Instagram at Florida Manta Girl. We also have a Facebook page for our project, Marine Megafauna Foundation : Americas. You can also go to the Marine Megafauna Foundation website. The Florida Manta Project has a project, and the Marine Megafauna Foundation in general is just doing tons of cool work, especially over in Mozambique, researching mantas and wedge fish and bull sharks and all kinds of good stuff.
Thank you so much. We so enjoyed this today.
Yeah, it was super fun.
Awesome. All right, Sharkies, that's all we have today with manta rays. And until next time,
swim you later. Hey Sharkies, if you've been enjoying Sharkpedia like we hope you have been, you can check out our Patreon, which is in the link tree in our bio on both Twitter and Instagram. And also, don't forget to rate and subscribe so that other people can find our podcast and hopefully hop on the train of loving sharks.
This episode was edited by Kayla Shue.